Ea ka aha ho o kolo kolo ki e ki e hano hano ua a ko ko ho maila. This Honorable Supreme Court is reconvened. E noho ilalo. Please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC16593, State of Hawaii versus William Reed Roy Carroll III. Arguing for the petitioner, Keith Shikitomi. Arguing for the respondent, Pa'aheo M. Kaho'o Halahala. Argument on the merits.
All right, good morning, Mr. Shikitomi and Ms. Kaho'o Halahala. Are you both ready to proceed? Very well. So, Mr. Shikitomi, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Kaho'o Halahala, 10-minute warning to go with the 10 minutes remaining in your allocution. So, please proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Keith Shigetomi, representing William Roy Carroll III. This case was referred to in Hilo as the King Kamehameha statute case. And in venues like Hilo, it's particularly difficult to select a fair and impartial juror because everyone who is arrested is published in the newspaper every day. And so it's a small place, as they say there. In any case, point one of our appeal deals with the jury selection procedures. And there were two challenges to jurors 35 and 48. And in particular, juror 35, when relating the her knowledge of the case before coming to court, indicated that she had made some decisions in her mind. And when questioned by the court whether or not she could set those opinions aside, she repeatedly said that, I can try. I hope so. I'll try not to let it affect me. And finally, when asked by Mr. Carroll's trial attorney, but you cannot guarantee us that, no, I cannot. That juror was challenged for cause. The court obviously denied that challenge. The second challenge was to juror number 48, who had indicated that not only had she had read about the case, but she had some strong family feelings about the case because they were sympathetic to what had happened. They worked in a Hawaiian immersion school, very strong opinions, and wanted someone punished. And when talking about her feelings about the case, she even agreed with the court when the court said that it seems to me that you are of the state of mind of presuming guilt as opposed to presuming innocence. And in that case, again, Mr. Carroll challenged for cause. The court denied that. Subsequent to that, Mr. Carroll asked for two additional peremptory challenges and was denied that. And so our appeal on point one deals with the challenge for the denial of the peremptory challenges because the challenges for cause were improperly or erroneously denied.
Mr. Shigetomi, we have a case, the Graham case from a while back, that says the prevailing rule is a person with preconceived notions can still serve if they can lay aside their impression or opinion and render a verdict based on the evidence. So the notion is that through further voir dire, those potential influences could be identified, and if the person indicates a willingness to set them aside, that they then might be able to serve as a juror. Was that test met here, or if it wasn't met in your view, why not?
Well, and obviously that's what happens in every situation when a juror comes up. You ask them whether or not they can set those feelings aside. And very often they'll tell you yes, or very often they'll tell you no. What I think the Supreme Court has also indicated is if they can set it aside and it meets an objective test that is something that is reasonable to believe, then yes, that person can still sit. However, I believe in this particular case, the fact that the juror says, I can try, I'll try not to let it affect me, I cannot guarantee, that would indicate an inability to do that, or at least some question as to whether or not she could do that. And the test has been stated that it's an objective test, whether or not the court can objectively believe that the person can set it aside, not simply taking the person's word to say, yes, I can set it aside. And I believe that in this particular case, with all the different questioning that, particularly as to Juror 35, that it was not objective to say that she could set that aside, and therefore that denial for cause was wrong, and therefore Mr. Carroll's rights to exercise his peremptory challenges was denied. And again, that doesn't require a showing of prejudice. As to Mr. Carroll's second point of appeal, which goes towards the evidence in terms of the value of either the damage to the statute or the value of the statute as it pertained to the theft charge, as well as the value of the pole and chain that we referred to count two, I believe, which or two or three, which was the theft of from the Bayfront Motors. And in that particular case, I'll take the easier one first. In terms of Bayfront Motors, all you did is, I think it was a number of years prior, the owner said, I had purchased the chain for $130. There's nothing in terms of the value as of that particular date and time, which was in 2000, and I think the incident was 2015, and therefore, because of 708801, if you can't ascertain the value, it's less than $100, and in this particular case, that would reduce that particular count to a petty misdemeanor. As towards the felony counts, the evidence that pertained to that came through Robert Yamada, who was who testified that he was, in fact, a construction manager for a state agency, and that he had been doing that for approximately 16 years at the time of trial. The state sought to have him qualified as an expert in the area of general contracting, which is something that he had previously done, but he had not done that for 16 years. The last time he worked as a contractor for his family business was in 2000, and this trial took place in 2016. He had no prior experience or knowledge of sculptures, art. He didn't know the exact composition of the metal. He didn't go check prices. He didn't consult with anyone. He simply gave his opinion as to what he estimated the value to be.
What about the value of the lift? So he seemed to have knowledge as to what it would cost to rent a lift, that to fix this would require going up, taking the bottom half of the spear off, and then coming back on another day and putting it back up. Why wouldn't that be sufficient evidence with regard to the criminal property damage account?
In terms of the lift, what was actually done was that the Hawaii County Fire Department volunteered the use of its truck, and they used that to raise up and to do the work that was required on the statue. Now, there was nothing in the record to indicate that he actually consulted with anyone. He simply said, well, it'd be $1,000. And there has to be some sort of foundation for that value, whether it be a lay opinion or whether it be an expert opinion. And in this particular case, he simply said, well, I believe if Yamada and Sons had did it, it would have cost $1,000. And there's nothing to support that in terms of any foundation, because any opinion or any statement by a lay witness has to be rationally based. And there's nothing to indicate here that any of the figures that he got were rationally based. He says, in terms of the statute, well, I'm going to assume that the statute was valued at $80,000. Well, what is that assumption based on? You can't just simply say, well, I'm going to assume that it's $80,000. You have to have something to say, well, we purchased it for $80,000. It was valued at $80,000. But there's nothing for that particular point in terms of the evidence. He talked about estimating how much it would cost to fix the chest, and he simply said, well, the last time the statue was restored, it took a few weeks. I'm figuring out how many hours, and in terms of the cost of the materials, his own words were, I just guessed at what the material costs would have been. He did not check any prices. He did not support any of his statements with any kind of information. Now, obviously, I wasn't there, but it seemed to me that in reading this transcript, he's simply answering questions to the best that he can, but he's picking them out of air. There's nothing to indicate what the basis for this testimony is. There's nothing to say that I did research. There's nothing to say that I looked into anything. In fact, he said, I did not consult with anyone. I simply used my experience as a general contractor some 16 years ago to come up with these figures. And so because of that, our position is that that evidence was improperly admitted, and if because of 708-801, if there is value, that value shall not exceed $100. Therefore, count the theft and the criminal property damage should have been a motion for judgment of acquittal had been granted down to theft 4, and I believe in criminal property damage would have been criminal property damage in the fourth degree. Getting to the third point, which is the sentencing argument, there was a plea agreement offered to Mr. Carroll, which said that you will get probation and we will take no position on a deferral. And the court went over that with Mr. Carroll, saying, hey, that is a deal that can protect you from a long jail sentence. And what happened at the end was obviously Mr. Carroll went to trial. He was convicted. And at sentencing, Judge Hara talked about how, and he focused his sentence on, well, because I don't believe you can be upfront and truthful with the probation officer, therefore I'm not going to give you probation. This is in spite of the fact that the probation officer, designated by the court, recommended a sentence of probation, recommended a jail sentence, which would provide for punishment, which would provide for deterrence, and the court ignored that, and the court referred to evidence at trial, which talked about, well, there was this video, and I saw you on the video, and you have a distinctive hairstyle. There are these other corroborating evidence, although he did say...
Is the court entitled to do that?
Entitled to do what specifically?
To make that kind of factual finding?
The court can make findings, sure. I mean, it obviously has to make findings when it's basing its decisions on motions for judgment of acquittal of that sort, whether or not if there was a motion for new trial or judgment of acquittal. It has to make its findings as to whether or not there's sufficient evidence.
In that regard, Mr. Shigatomi, following up on what Justice Pollack said, to what extent, if at all, can the judge at sentencing remark about the fact that it appeared the defendant was not telling the truth?
I believe that obviously if a person is not truthful to the court, that is something that the court consider in making a statement.
But he didn't testify, right?
Right. He didn't testify. He didn't testify. And I guess the crux of that point is that the court specifically referred to the trial evidence and seemed to be saying because of that trial evidence, I'm going to give you the open term.
Right, and in a sense, he's saying that because of the evidence that unfolded, it appeared that the defendant was guilty, and the position he'd been taking was that he's not guilty. So would the court be precluded from taking that into consideration because the defendant, for example, didn't testify?
Well, obviously, you can't take the defendant's silence against him. I mean, that's clear.
Sure.
In this particular case, he didn't testify. These statements in these pre-sentence reports cannot be used for any purpose other than for the court's purpose. But in reading the transcript, in reading what prefaced that in terms of, well, this is a venerated symbol, this is something that damages the public, the fact that he went to trial, despite the fact that he was offered a favorable plea agreement, which could have resulted in there being actually no conviction, Because...
Let me ask you that one question. Yes. Sorry to interrupt, but when the court says... The court basically said it would go along with it?
Well, it didn't say that because he wasn't doing it, but he did say that it would... What did the court say specifically? It says, so I want to make sure that you understand what those consequences are and what the benefits possibly of agreeing to the plea agreement that's being offered by the state here. As I see it, the real big plus is that you would be avoiding any exposure to prison. I mean, that is his statement to the defendant when they were putting on the record that there was this plea agreement and that he was not accepting it, and therefore he wanted to exercise his right to trial.
Can you read it back to me, that he would avoid?
As I see it, the real plus is that you would be avoiding any exposure to prison.
So that is at least a sentencing inclination and perhaps an indication that the court would bind itself to it.
Correct, because there wasn't any plea agreement at that point.
Okay, now isn't the court required under our law, under SANI, before a court makes a sentencing inclination, the court has to be familiar with the offense and the defendant's record adequate enough to make a reasoned and informed judgment as to the appropriate remedy? Isn't that what we've said?
That's what SANI said, yes.
Okay. So at that point, one has to assume that the court had to have been familiar with what had occurred, familiar with his record, and familiar enough to say, look, you're not going to get jail. In fact, you can get a deferral. And the same judge after trial sentenced this individual to 5 years prison.
Well, SANI postdated this, right?
Yes. This... The record is not real clear as to what the court knew. All I can tell you is that this is what is indicated at, I guess, one of the conference or the pretrial statuses where they want to put on the record that there was a plea agreement proposed and that Mr. Carroll was not accepting that. So whether or not the court was aware of any more than that, I can't tell you that. I just know that this is what is said, but to me that indicates the court informing Mr. Carroll that it would in fact bind itself to a Rule 11 plea agreement. And so when you look at it, the fact that there was this proposed plea agreement, what the court seemed to indicate it was willing to follow, that could also result in the cases being dismissed if Mr. Carroll successfully completed a deferral, then turn around after a trial in which he didn't testify, and that there is nothing to indicate that he testified, well, obviously he can't testify falsely if you don't testify, and the fact that he didn't seem to like some of the statements that were made, and he didn't particularly like the fact that this statue was damaged.
What relevance is it that he testified or not? In other words, if he didn't testify and there's no... There's a lack of evidence that would refute the government's case, that would be a set of circumstances with respect to the evidence the judge would review that would suggest perhaps a stronger record of guilt than if the defendant did testify. So what difference does it make? I mean, I would assume you would concede that the situation's different after the judge sits through a trial and sees all the evidence than it is before the trial when the judge is just looking at the representations that have been made by counsel and without a pre-sentence report.
Well, the fact that he doesn't testify, clearly that can't be held against him in determining guilt or innocence. The fact that he doesn't testify cannot be used against him in terms of making a more severe sentence. I believe that if you do testify and you...
I guess the analysis would be that the judge isn't considering that the defendant didn't testify. The judge is just looking at the evidence that came through. But, I mean, in terms of the strength of the evidence, I don't think, yeah, I agree with you, to well, recognize that the defendant didn't testify and hold that against him for some reason would clearly be in violation of his right against self-incrimination. But to just look at the record and say the evidence seems quite strong at this point and it's a different record than the one I was looking at before trial began, on the basis of this record, I'm going to impose sentence.
Well, the judge seems to be, and again, obviously this is my reading, but the judge seems to be upset at the fact that it went to trial. And the fact that it went to trial with a video, and that in the court's mind, that is you in the video, and the fact that we had to sit through this trial, despite the fact that you were offered a favorable plea agreement, which the court indicated it was, the fact that we have a probation officer who is recommending probation, and I mean, I can tell you that is not common in Hilo. I mean, that's an aside, but that is not common in Hilo. And so, particularly for a publicized case like that, the fact that that particular probation officer recommended probation, recommended a deterrence, recommended a punishment, but the court felt that for whatever reason, it was insufficient. And in specifying the reasons, specifically referred to the trial evidence. And said, I saw you in the video. And if it was anything else, you know, the evidence was sort of weak, but that is what spoke to me. The fact that you are in that video, we had to go to trial, and because of that, I'm sentencing you to the 5 years in prison.
Let me ask you this, and I guess this was the basis of my question, maybe it wasn't. In other words, I asked if there was anything wrong with the judge making that finding, but I guess what I'm really asking is, did the defendant ever deny that that wasn't him in the video?
There seems to be some statements in the pre-sentence.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the trial.
No. He did not testify at all. There was no witness.
And isn't he entitled to say, you know, I want a trial. I want you to have to prove every element, whether it's value or whatever it is, whether it's proving it's me or whatever. So I'm perplexed by the court's comment that it was him.
Well, what was the defense?
The defense was reasonable doubt that they didn't prove the value, that they couldn't, even with the video, it couldn't prove that Mr. Carroll was the person who committed the offense, because the video was, obviously it was not of the incident itself. So that was the defense. There was no witnesses called, nothing to, it was simply, hey, the state has to prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt. And it seemed as if the court seemed to be perturbed by that fact that they have to go to trial in light of the fact that the court viewed the evidence as strong. And that's what immediately preceded the five-year sentence, is the fact that, hey, and on top of that, I'm troubled by what I perceive to be inconsistent statements, and the fact that he's the specific reference to the tape, your unique hairstyle, and our position is that it was a punishment for exercising his right to go to trial, and therefore that the sentence should have been, well, at this point, the sentence should be vacated and set for a renewed sentencing hearing.
Very well. Anything further at this point, Mr. Shigatum? All right, we'll reserve your time for rebuttal. Ms. Kaho'ohalahala, your argument.
Aloha and good morning, Chief Justice, Associate Justices, Ha'ahel Koho'ohalahala, on behalf of the respondent, State of Hawaii. So I want to start this morning by clarifying some of the trial facts. So in regards to the value, for all intended purposes, the witness who testified to value, Mr. Yamada, he was qualified as an expert. Maybe not specifically in the record, but for all intended purposes, the state asked the court to qualify this witness to solicit testimony from his experience as a general contractor and an estimator. And he was very specific in the methods that he used to establish value.
And value as to what?
Value as to First of all, the top portion of the spear or ihe that was removed from the statue also valued...
As to repair costs?
As to repair
all right,
costs.
So and also putting aside CPD, criminal property damage,
yes.
My question relates to the theft count.
Okay.
Theft value means the market value of the property or services at the time and place of the offense. And it, by services, it means the services that you stole, so, that you took. So, and replacement cost, if the market value of the property cannot be determined. So, replacement cost, are you saying that the repair costs are the replacement costs?
So the witness actually answered in two ways. He specifically mm-hmm. indicated that if I, based on my qualifications as a general contractor and as an estimator, this would be my estimate as to the market value today. And he based that information, he said that the $80,000 that he started as his base of how he got to that estimate was not just an arbitrary number that he got out of nowhere. If you look in the record, Exhibit 323 in the trial is a letter from the Princeville Corporation, which indicated how much the value was at the time that they purchased it, which was $80,000. So he based his estimate on that as a base, and he said, if you look at the statue as a whole, and this is all in the transcript, he said, I got...
But that was the value of the artwork or the as a piece of
how
art?
How much they purchased the...
The purchase price.
The purchase price.
They being the Princeville Corporation.
Yes. Yeah. And then the Princeville Corporation basically in that same letter, which is in the record on appeal...
What was his qualifications as an expert? What was he qualified as?
So he was qualified as a general contractor, and he indicated not just that he had been doing this for several years, but he was currently licensed. He said, I renew my license every 2 years.
And general contractors do also place artwork into premises.
Yes, and in fact, he was the general contractor that had been on a commission that put this statute in place mm-hmm. when it was originally brought over from Kauai, and he also was a general contractor that actually did replace it. So those were his qualifications. He also indicated as an estimator, that's what he does. He makes estimates for projects such as the repairing the statute in this case, and that he had a method of doing it, and he indicated how he did that. It was by a method called hip shooting, and basically
I couldn't hear what you said.
Hip shooting, that was the method that he used, and he indicated that in using that method, he takes into consideration manpower, materials, and overhead, which could include administrative costs, taxes, and that method as an estimator is what he used to give bids to the insurance company, so that when he bids on, like, say, a state project or whatnot, that he's the person giving the bid. And so that's the method that he normally uses, and based on that method, that's how he came to determine the values for the statute in this case. So
what about the lift on the criminal property damage? Mr. Shigatomi said he just pulled those numbers out of thin air. What's your response to that?
So if you look closely at the transcript when he testified, he indicated that he did ask the fire department if they could come back and if they could use their lift to reinsert the spear back onto the statue. And he had asked specifically them for their services because he knew that when the police were investigating this case that they had used the fire department's ladder to take photographs and other evidence as part of their investigation. So he, through his contacts, he indicated that he contacted them and he had them come back and use, and he said that is similar to a man lift, and a man lift, the price for that would be this much, which I believe he indicated would be approximately $1,000. And then he also specifically said it took this many people to actually, in fact, reinstall the top portion of the ihe back onto the statue, and the man hours for that amount of people, I believe he said between 4 and 5, would be approximately another $1,500. And so that's how he got to those estimates. He also indicated that even before he had to reinstall the top portion off, they had to take the bottom portion of the ihe out of the statute so they could put it back together as one piece. And that also did require a man lift, and that is what Yamada and Sons used in order to have that done. And he gave an estimate that of how much that would be. That was, again, based on his qualifications as a general contractor and estimator. And for all intents and purposes, the court did find him as an expert, because if you look at the jury instructions, the jury instruction as to an expert witness was also given.
Okay. Could you talk about the juror issue, and in particular juror number 48? So both jurors had heard something about the case in the media, but juror 48 had family members who felt very strongly about the case. Why isn't that a separate and distinct grounds for concern and for excusing that witness?
I think juror number 48 was very honest in her answers to the court during the jury selection process. I believe she indicated to the court, you know, I may have gotten some information from my family members.
I'm sorry, I'm having a little trouble understanding you. If you could speak a little slower, maybe get a little closer to the microphone. Thank you.
Thank you, Justin.
Okay, just take a moment while we silence the phone, please. And just ask all the members in the audience if they can't have your phones on silent. We appreciate it. So please continue.
So in regards to juror number 48, I think her initial, the court's questioning at this point of the jury selection was, what information have you been exposed to prior to coming to court today? And so she wanted to inform the court that, you know, I may have gotten some information, like I found out about what happened to the Kamehameha statute from members of my family, and they were upset about it. But juror 48 never said herself that she was upset about it or she could not put that aside. She ultimately said that she could be fair in this case, and that that would not affect her. So I don't see how that was overly prejudicial. If she had,
do we have to accept her own assessment? I mean, do courts hear a juror say, I can be fair, and despite what's been disclosed, the court is to accept it? Is that?
I think deference should be given to the trial court. They're in the front line, if you will, of determining whether or not a person can be fair and impartial. And so the trial court didn't just take their answers for surface value. If you look at, I believe, the trial court indicated at the motion for new trial, which raised the same issues, the jury selection, specifically to jurors 35 and 48, he indicated, I also took into consideration their demeanor in answering the questions, their demeanor and the manner in which they answered it. And he, quite frankly, found them credible in the way that they answered their questions. And so I think that the appellate courts need to basically give great deference to the trial courts in determining as a whole how credible a juror is in their mannerisms when they're answering.
Do we also look at, though, the way the court asks the questions and whether or not the court is, I mean, these were pretty leading questions that the court asked the jurors, were they not? About whether, you know, after she disclosed, you know, she said, look, I have children who go to Nawahi and that who were impacted. I have another child who's a Hawaiian activist. And then the judge asked about the recollection. She says, you know, they talked to me about where the items were found. She didn't know who in the family. It seems like there's so many members. And then it was disclosed that she has children who were teachers at the school, grandchildren who were at the school, and then it turned out to be the activist wasn't even those individuals, it was somebody else in the family. And when she describes them, she says they were very upset, and then she talks about the statue being desecrated. That's pretty strong language.
I think at this point of the jury selection, it was only to determine or find out from the jurors who had been placed in the jury box so far what outside exposure they had gotten prior to coming to court. At that point, the trial court hadn't introduced or explained any concepts of law, including the presumption of innocence, the state's burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. He's simply trying to figure out, you know, what pretrial publicity or any other information you may have about this case at that point. So I don't think that the court's questions were leading. I think he did actually a very thorough job in determining whether they could set it aside. And he went one step further and said, okay, not just can you set it aside, but how fairly do you think you can do, how well do you think you can do that? So not just can you do it, but how successful would you be if you tried to do that? And juror number 48's answer was 90%. So I think that's a high degree.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Ms. Kohala, but I wanted to ask you to give me your advice about this 10%.
Yes.
So it appears from the record that it has been established after the questioning by the judge that this juror had a point of view of 10% about something. And in looking at the record, I'm interested in what your thoughts are about that, because when Mr. Muniz questioned juror 48, said, is that extra 10% in your certainty level, is there a bit of it that you would want Mr. Carroll to somehow prove to you that he's not the one, or prove to you that he's innocent? And the next answer that she gives addresses the 10% and said that would be the 10%. But I just wanted to get clear from your point of view, is she saying at that point that she has a 10% commitment to the idea that the defendant is guilty and has to prove his innocence?
So I think if you look at the way that the question was posed from Mr. Munoz, was highly suggestive, are you saying that this is what it is? And she kind of just agreed with him. So I don't think she specifically came out and said the 10% that I'm reserving as to my probability of how well I will be at being fair and impartial. I think he kind of suggested that, and she just agreed with him and said, okay, yeah. But and then after that, the trial court clarified, like, and then he explained to her, like, you know, the defense has no burden, and basically explained the burden of proof to her. And after she was explained that concept of law, she indicated, okay, I understand now, and I can be fair. And she wasn't saying that that's what the 10% was. And the court actually addressed that the second time the defense counsel moved to excuse that both jurors, 35 and 48, for cause. The second time, and he said it's not a burden shifting, that's not what the juror said. Like, you may have took it as that, but that's not what the juror actually, or potential juror actually said.
Well, what she did say was, I guess my feeling on that has to be the fact that I have a lot of faith in the police, and that what they do and what they put together and who they arrest, that would be the 10%. So she's saying the 10% is based on her faith in the police, that they don't arrest people that didn't do it. How can we say that this juror gave the defendant the presumption of innocence?
I think even though that's how she may have responded to that specific question, if you look at the jury selection as a whole, and after this specific part that is only referencing pretrial publicity, and you look at the other questions that the court asked her after she stated that, then I think the record of as a whole, she indicates she can be fair. And the judge even later on explains to all of the jurors, you know, each concept of law and whether you can follow the court's instructions. And that,
I'm just really curious, were they running out of jurors at this point? Is that what was going on?
At that was the first day of jury selection, so at that time, no.
Okay.
You know, what about when the trial judge says, criticizes apparently the defendant for telling the probation officer he didn't do it? Isn't that problematic?
So the state's position and reading on the reasons why the court brought that up at sentencing.
It's a question of whether or not he'd be amenable to probation.
Yes.
However, he did still, is it appropriate, even if he's amenable to probation, to take into consideration that he told the probation officer, I didn't do it, so that means, that tells me that you're not truthful?
I think what the court was, in the state's position in reading all of the factors that the trial court talked about in his sentencing, I think he was indicating that how can probation be, one of the points that he took is how can probation be appropriate for you when we can't even figure out what type of rehabilitative services would be good for you in helping you to be rehabilitated, because if you can't be honest with the court or with your probation officer, then probation's not going to work for you. And I think that that's told to defendants every day.
Even when they don't testify?
Yes, even when they don't testify. And I think another thing that the court could have been getting at is that in the PSI report, he indicates that he doesn't have any problems, including substance abuse or alcohol problems. And then the defense attorney in his sentencing argument himself says, even though the defendant denied that, he has a problem. And so I think the court could have considered that also, that your own defense attorney is indicating you have these problems, but we can't work with you if you're not at that starting point where you can be rehabilitated.
But didn't the court indicate that it was inclined to give him probation, that he should take the plea deal because he would get probation and he would be able to avoid jail?
The trial court never indicated on the record, at least where I could find in the transcripts, or that he was inclined to follow the prosecutor's offer. He basically was informing him, this is the offer that you have, and that he also, and if you look at I believe it's the May 4th hearing where he goes over what the state's offer is, he also informs the defendant that you also have a pending case in the First Circuit. So if you are found guilty here, and if you get a prison sentence, which is possible, then you won't be able to get probation in the First Circuit court because those are inconsistent and would be illegal sentences. So I think
your position is that the trial court did not suggest, at least, that it would be inclined to follow the plea agreement?
I don't see anywhere specifically where the trial court said, I am inclined to follow this plea offer.
I thought what was read to us is you can't avoid prison. I don't have it in front of me, but is that what the court said? Why would the court go over a plea agreement on the record and tell the defendant, look, you can avoid something if the court wasn't sending a pretty darn strong signal? I mean, is that something a court normally does, go over a plea agreement and then say, oh, but by the way, I'm not going to do that? I mean, what kind of...
What if he had pled at that point and the state had also taken the position that the offenses were deferral eligible and the state wasn't going to take a position? What if he had pled and the defense had moved for DAG and the court had imposed prison? Do you think that would have been upheld as a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary change of plea at that point based on the court's statements at that Fry hearing?
Possibly. I mean, there is nothing on the record that the court said, there's a Rule 11 on the record, I'm bound by this offer. I don't think there's anything specific about that.
Do you think that courts should be suggesting that they're going to go along with a plea offer and then be able to change their mind? Be able to suddenly say, nope, sorry, you changed your plea, I'm going to impose prison?
I think the precedent in Hawaii, and there is, I don't know the name of the case, but it basically indicates if the court gives an inclination, then the remedy is to withdraw their plea, or the court must follow what the inclination is.
And how, in this case, was it not, was the defendant not punished for going to trial? How could we rule that the defendant wasn't punished for going to trial?
Just because the ultimate sentence was not what the plea offer was, I don't think that there's any basis of law, at least
well,
that I know of.
Well, if the court doesn't say it's inclined to go with it, perhaps, but if the court is suggesting that if the defendant changes his plea, he will get probation or perhaps even a deferral,
I think,
and then imposes the maximum prison term concurrently, but
I think if that were the facts of this case, then perhaps, but at that point, the defendant rejected the plea offer, so there was
so he can be penalized for going to trial then. If he had pled, he wouldn't have gotten prison, but he goes to trial and he's convicted, and therefore he gets the full prison term. How is that not punishment?
At the point where anyone rejects the plea offer, then anything at that point is on the table. The state's not bound by it, and certainly the court's not bound by it. That's
the state's position, that once a plea offer is made, and the state, I assume, makes its plea offers based on understanding what the defendant's at least priors are. I'm sure you look at the priors and things, and then you have an understanding based on the investigations or the police report what the underlying facts are. You make a plea offer of probation, no jail, and you're saying at that point if the defendant exercises the defendant's right to go to trial and is convicted, the state is then free. The state and the court are free to say, forget it, you went to trial, therefore you get the maximum prison term.
At the time,
is that at the what time, the Constitution says?
At the time the state makes a plea offer, that is the least, like the minimum sentence that the state would be comfortable with if the case did not proceed to trial. I think definitely, I mean, absolutely.
So plea offers are basically trial avoidance measures only. And once you go to trial, it's fair game.
I wouldn't say that. I would say that the plea bargaining process is part of the judicial system. And so if the state was bound by whatever it offered prior to going to trial, then I would say majority of the cases in
well, it couldn't be bound because sometimes you would offer you would offer a lesser, which is probationable, and the defendant is convicted of the greater, which is not. So, I mean, you wouldn't be able to. The defendant doesn't get the benefit of the lesser, but
if the state was bound by whatever its plea offer was originally, I don't think that would be a good policy for judicial economy.
Okay, well, what about judges? What about judges? When the judges state an inclination, putting aside the prosecutor's office, when the judge suggests that they're inclined to go with probation.
I think after a trial, the court has more information and more facts about a case that he would not necessarily be privy to prior to the case going to trial.
Would one of those facts be the fact that the defendant has continued, the defendant has exercised the right to go to trial, said not guilty, decided not to testify, defendant tells the probation officer, I'm not guilty, and the court says, okay, well, I'm going to give you 5 years for continuing to assert your innocence.
I think what the trial court indicated is that and it's in the transcript, he indicates, I have conflicting statements from you. On the one hand, there is a witness, so not the defendant, but a witness who testified that you told him that you were the one who did this to the statute.
Wasn't that all known beforehand?
Not to the trial court. I don't think at that point the voluntariness hearing as to those statements never happened at the point of the plea negotiations. So no, the trial court may not have known that information.
So the court gave an inclination without its familiarity with the record? I mean, that's...
Well, the trial court doesn't have a PSI at that point in time, right? And doesn't
correct.
Have the information that comes out at trial. And if the trial court gives an inclination, that's not hidebound.
That's right. The state would agree with that position.
You were referring to the determination of the court with respect to sentence based on the evidence at trial, but it appears that the sentencing, from the judge's point of view, required sending the defendant to jail for 5 years because, in part, of some concern about telling the truth. Would that be fair to say? The judge was concerned about the defendant telling the truth or being truthful?
I think that the court was looking at the factors in 706.621 and 706.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to ask you to recite the factors in 706. I was wondering whether or not you would concede that one of the bases for the sentencing had to do with the judge's concern about the defendant telling the truth. Would that be fair from the record?
I think the judge was concerned on whether or not probation would be a good sentence for this particular defendant.
Okay. Well, if I could also ask you about whether the judge thought it was probation was a good idea, but I did want to ask you whether you thought the judge based the determination of sentencing in part on whether the defendant was truthful or telling the truth.
I think the court was clear, and he specifically stated it in the record, that he's basing his sentencing on 706.
Would you deny that the court based its determination in part on whether or not the defendant was telling the truth?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Would you deny that the court was making its sentencing determination based in part on whether the defendant was being truthful?
I think that is one of the factors the court took into consideration.
Okay, so can you explain to me how the court came to that conclusion if the defendant wasn't of truthful character? And as you recall, the court was quite concerned about the video, and in the video seemed to be saying, look, that's you, that's you. So I'm interested in your interpretation of the record. What was the court referring to as evidence when it spoke about its concern of the defendant being truthful?
I think what the court was concerned about is whether this particular defendant is probationable. And if you're not, if you cannot be honest with the probation department at this point, then you are not a good candidate for probation. I think it is one of the factors he took into consideration in looking at each of the statutory requirements that a judge needs to consider.
Well, the reason I'm asking this, I was just concerned that one of the reasons that he may have found that the defendant was not truthful is because the defendant didn't testify, or the defendant's position was inconsistent with the idea that it was inconsistent with the idea that the defendant developed that it wasn't him.
I understand your concern, Justice Mohsen. The state's take, without actually asking the court what, you know, the trial judge, what did you intend when you brought that up? The state's position is that the court used that to make a determination on whether or not the defendant was probationable.
Well, would you agree that if the court found that the defendant was not truthful because of the fact he didn't testify, that that would be an improper basis upon which to impose a sentence?
Yes, I don't think that all defendants have a right not to testify, so I don't think the court was basing it on the fact that the defendant chose not to testify. I don't think that's what the trial court was doing. The trial court was saying, we are here at this point, and we cannot work with you or rehabilitate you if you are not able to be honest with the probation officer.
So in other words, unless you admit your guilt, regardless of the fact that you didn't testify, you're not eligible for probation.
I don't think it was necessarily to guilt of the facts of the case. He also indicated that he didn't have any problems, and that included any substance abuse problems and any problems with drinking, which other people, he already at that point had, I believe, two DUI convictions, and his own counsel indicated these are the problems that he has. He needs mental health treatment, and he needs help with his alcoholism, and the defendant wasn't even able to admit that to the probation officer.
Did the defendant say that he wouldn't follow through on mental health or substance abuse treatment?
The defendant specifically said at sentencing, I will follow any probation terms.
Very well. Anything further at this time, Ms. Kahala-Halahala?
Nothing further.
Very well. Thank you for your argument. Mr. Shigatomi, your rebuttal.
I just have a couple real quick points. One, in terms of the jury selection, it's always frustrating when the court tries to objectify a very subjective standard. When I ask, well, how certain are you? I mean, 90%, how do you measure 90%? That's still subjective. And I don't think that the court should use that as the basis, because the court has said we have to look at an objective, not subjective self-righteousness. So that's my point on that.
And but I think that may be problematic and maybe something we can't avoid, but generally it's, you know, judge, you know, I have 90% certainty that I can, you know, put what I know aside, or 90% certainty I won't do this or that. But this is something different. As Justice McKenna, you know, read, her 10% has to do with, I guess my feeling has to be that I have a lot of faith in the police, and that's what they do, and what they put together, and who they arrest. That would be the 10%. In other words, 10% of this, Judge, is that, you know, they got, I'm going with the government. And when they ask her the follow-up questions, it's just as ambiguous. The attorney tries to follow up, and she says, well, I would base my opinion on what proof there is. And this goes back to what she had said previously, I think, saying, you know, the defense had a burden. I guess I'd also feel if there was proof, it's got to be somewhat sustainable. Or why would it be proved? It seems like she's still going back again to what the police said. And the court doesn't really go back.
In terms of the passage that you're referring to, the court asked if that juror could follow the court's instructions. And it says, well, if this evidence points that he was not the one, then I'll be able to overcome, but it would have to be pretty good evidence. And again, that coupled with the fact that she had a lot of confidence in the police department is, while not uncommon, is something that cannot be used and should be. And in this particular case, our argument is that she could not set that aside, and therefore the challenge was
And
denied.
You know, the law seems to be that you don't look at these kind of issues. When somebody is telling the court, look, I have family members, maybe 5 or 6 family members that have potentially spoken to her and expressed opinions and things like that. Not only do we look at that, but under the law, it appears that we're supposed to look at the overall circumstances, the nature, how it, in this particular case, and we have a very, very sensitive case, a very, very significant case, and this is someone that is, you know, brings their life experiences.
What is the standard of review? I'm sorry, on refusal to grant a
Challenge of a challenge for cause is abuse of discretion.
Abuse of discretion.
Right, but our test set up.
Mr. Shigatomi, I'm interested in your perspective on how the judge should approach this idea of the exercise of its discretion. What should the standard be in exercising discretion? And in our Iluli case, the court said, if a prospective juror expresses serious doubts about her ability to be fair and impartial, she must be excused for cause unless she ultimately assures the trial court that she will base her decision solely upon the evidence. So I guess we have a test of sorts that has to do with whether the juror has raised serious doubts. So this discussion about 10% remaining in terms of the way she would look at the case, perhaps as Justice McKenna and Justice Pollack have suggested, perhaps from the point of view that she feels the defendant needs to prove innocence, is that a serious doubt about her ability to be fair and impartial? Because it's only 10%.
She says it's 10%. We don't know if it's 10%. All we know is what she's told us before, that her family had very strong opinions. Her family was upset. Her family wanted someone to be punished, that they were activists. We also know that she expressed her belief in the ability of the Honolulu County, Hawaii County Police Department to do their job, and therefore that if this person here is before the court, then I believe that he did it because that's what the police do. Now, whether or not that 10% is, well, I have that Mr. Carroll had to prove it or not, I'm just saying that I think with that record that that juror should have been disqualified. And finally, in regards to the testimony of Bobby Amata, it's not real clear whether or not he's actually designated an expert, because I think Third Circuit is one of those where they just tell you proceed after you ask to have someone qualified. But I will say this, the fact that even if he was qualified as an expert does not give him a blank check to pull any number that he wants to out of the air, because any opinion by an expert has to be based on fact. It has to be based on something that's relied upon in the industry, and that was never presented, and therefore his opinions, even if they were of an expert, were improperly admitted. So unless there's anything else, I don't have anything further.
Very well. Thank you very much, Mr. Shigatomi. Thank you to both of our attorneys. The courts will take this matter under advisement.
Iku iluna, please rise. Ua ho'o malolo i o mai ne, kea aha ho'o kolo kolo ki e ke hano hano. This Honorable Supreme Court is now recessed.